So the title of this talk is Inspiration from the Therigatha, the Songs of the Sisters. And then addressing the material, trying to find a way to present it. I have a subtitle which is Refuge, Renunciation, and Right Understanding. So what I wanted to do is assemble some of the material in a way that I could share it from the point of view of where I've gotten my inspiration from these verses. Because, of course, I could also present more of a history, and certainly I should say a few things about the history. But then I did want to be able to read you some of these verses and point to a few things, share some things about the inspiration and the teaching that I get from these verses. But historically, there's a lot of interesting, maybe controversy, input, and so forth about the beginning of the Sangha of Women. And it's kind of an exciting time right now because people are looking at the material historically and the translations and so forth to see what may have actually occurred, to see what might just be stories added later and so forth. And of course, we've all noticed that the tradition is quite patriarchal, but what helped me was to notice that the whole planet is, right, for about 10,000 years. So Buddhism is only 2,500 years old, so of course anything in that range would be unfold in that way, sociologically, so to speak. So the nuns, the early nuns, the first nuns in these enlightened order, which these verses come from, that order was begun about 20 years after the Buddha began teaching and took monks. So the order is actually made up of the head, which was the Buddha's stepmother, and a lot of the wives, mothers, sisters of all of these monks, because when they left, then the women were alone in a lot of the situation. And the Buddha didn't make it easy for women to join the order. In fact, again, people are looking historically to see what of the various stories can actually be traced back. But it's said that when his stepmother asked, she had all of these women who wanted to join the order, and he refused, and that he supposedly refused three times. But then later, she shaves her head, dons robes, they all don robes. Don't know how many there actually were. They say 500, but you'll notice when you're reading the old material, whenever there's a large number, it's 500. So, you know, a lot. and they walked an enormous number of miles to a place where the Buddha was teaching to ask again. And this time, which has always, of course, made me love Ananda, he intercedes. There's a sequence, a dialogue, and you can read about it, where he asks the Buddha if, in fact, women would have any problem in all the various aspects of attaining enlightenment. And there's a sequence of questions, and the Buddha keeps saying, no, women wouldn't have any problem with that, wouldn't have any problem with that. So then he finally says, well, then maybe, you know, maybe it'd be nice if you let them ordain since they want to. So at that point, the women's sangha started. But there are special rules that are given, precepts that are added that makes the whole women's sangha very subordinate to the men's sangha in many ways that makes modern women and modern men a little bit jittery when we read it, a little bit of a sense of, wait a minute, this doesn't sound exactly fair. So then people talk and theorize, are there social reasons for that? Did he make it difficult intentionally? And so forth. And of course, one cannot know for sure, but you can read various people see what you think and so forth. In any case, they happily ordain under those rules, and happily they go forth, and happily they accomplish quite a lot. And the verses are very much in the tradition of enlightenment verses. So they're all arhants, and they speak some of these verses a little bit about their story and how they were released from suffering. It was interesting because I kept calling this talk inspiration. And then I noticed there's a piece published, Buddhist Publication Society. She published it in the 80s, Susan Jutla. And she also called her book Inspiration from the Terry's, The Songs of the Sisters. And I think it's just the situation is, of course, that being female, one reads so much, of course, the Buddha and the writings of the monks and so forth, and so the male authors. So as a female person, it's just an inspiration to hear the female voice because, of course, it's different. And if the situation were reversed, that would be the same, of course, for men. So we do this feeling of inspiration and hearing that voice and having the opportunity to hear that voice. It's just, it's nice. So I wanted to share some with you of the content. And for me, again, trying to reflect on what it was that I so appreciate in reading these verses. And I felt that the categories of refuge, renunciation, and right understanding might be a way, might be an angle where I could share. So that's what I'll do a little bit. First before that, though, I'm reading mostly the translations by Thanissaro Bhikkhu, Ajahn Thanissaro, Metta Forest Monastery in Southern California. An amazing, brilliant man, brilliant translator. I did have the opportunity to study with him a bit when I was at the Berry Center for Buddhist Studies, really appreciating him a lot. If you ever get a chance to go down there and practice, it's an avocado grove, but he's in the Thai forest tradition. Translated a lot of what we have of Ajahn Mun, Ajahn Mahabua, Ajahn Phung. Those booklets that we have of translations are Thanissaro Bhikkhu, Ajahn Thanissaro, Jeffrey DeGraff, Ajahn Jeff. There's a few words I should just mention beforehand. There will be at the ends of some of the verses a reference to having accomplished the three knowledges and maybe being effluent free. So those words, basically it's fully enlightened, the arhants is what that means. But there's a phrase effluent, the mental effluence. Sometimes it's translated as a pollutant, that there are four effluents that stream forth from the mind, sensuality, beliefs and views, and bhava, becoming, the energy of becoming, and the energy of ignorance. And they flow out of the mind stream, and they create this, it's an image of water, so it's a flood of the round of birth and death, birth and rebirth, birth and death and rebirth. So that's what the word effluent means. So when one is effluent free, one has ended that round of rebirth. Occasionally they'll be mentioned that they have accomplished the divine eye, which is also the first of the three knowledges. In the evening before the Buddha's enlightenment, in the first watch of the night, he accomplished knowledge of all of his previous lives, the knowledge and the memory of all of his previous lives, and the causes and conditions flowing through them. And then at the second watch of the night, he saw how all beings are born and die, and the cycle of karma, and the karma of other beings as well. And then the third watch of the night, he saw clearly what we call dependent origination, the arising and ceasing of all phenomena, and how that worked. So that's the three knowledges that's often referred to in these verses, accomplishing the three knowledges. So they're just ways of saying that they attained arhatship. All righty, so the first story is, I think of it as, in the category of inspiration for me, about refuge and also about renunciation. It's Anupama, the millionaire's daughter. And I always like to reflect as well, the Buddha, these early monks, and then these early women, an enormous percentage of them were from the wealthy class. You know, the Buddha was a prince. So these were all of his friends and relatives and so forth. And so when they let go of all the accoutrements of ordinary life, it wasn't just like my ordinary life, you know. It was wealth of the highest status in their culture. So I particularly feel that we can take their words quite seriously when they talk about the accomplishments, the joy of renunciation. They weren't renouncing just things that I would renounce. They were renouncing all of what the culture had to offer. So Anupama is the millionaire's daughter. Born in a high-ranking family, with much property, great wealth, consummate in complexion and figure, I was the daughter of Majha, the treasurer. Sons of kings sought for me. Sons of rich merchants longed for me. One of them sent my father a messenger saying, "Give me Anupama. I will give in return 8 times her weight in jewels and gold." But I, having seen the one self-awakened, unsurpassed, excelling the world, paid homage to his feet, sat down to one side. He, Gotama, from sympathy taught me the Dhamma. And as I sat in that very seat, I attained the third fruit of non-return. So just sitting listening, she moved to the third stage of enlightenment. Then I cut off my hair and went forth into homelessness. Today is the 7th day since I made craving wither away. So 7 days later, she became an arhat. It's lucky when you're born in the time of a Buddha, you know? You just go listen like that. But we do our best in our time. So again, she's voicing all that she had, all her beauty, all her riches, all that was offered for her, and yet saying how much she prefers the choice that she made. But then on the other side, for example, we have Chanda, the beggar. And again, this particular story of this woman, for me, the feeling of refuge in, both in the path, but also that these women went to other women and got help, got teachings from other women. So that sense of also refuge in the Sangha, and particularly the Sangha of women. And I know that for myself, it was important for me in the particularly when I started doing the longer, the 3-month retreats, In order to keep going, not only every sitting would I take refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, but then just a little bit, it was sort of like a feeling of, sisters, help me. That kind of feeling. Tears still come because there was a sense of needing support from that Sangha as well. So I'd add that little refuge for myself. So Chanda says, before I had fallen on evil times. No husband, no children, no relatives, no friends, no way to obtain clothing and food. So taking a staff and bowl in hand, begging for alms from house to house, feverish from the cold and heat, I wandered for 7 full years. So in her case, this, she just became a mendicant beggar, but she hadn't met any teacher. Then, seeing a nun obtaining food and drink, I approached her and said, let me go forth into homelessness. She, Patachara, from sympathy, let me go forth. Then, exhorting me, urged me on to the highest goal. Hearing her words, I did her bidding. Her exhortation was not in vain. Endowed with the 3 knowledges, I am effluent free. They're kind of nice stories because they live happily ever after at the end, you know? It's really, really nice. So Patachara is mentioned in a lot of the verses on the Songs of the Sisters. She had many students that she took care of. She was the teacher of a group of women. So this one is Patachara's 30 students. So these are 30 women, a kind of a group verse of 30 women who studied, practiced with her. And again, you get the feeling here of refuge in the Buddha, but then also refuge in their teacher, and who was a woman, and their gratitude, their enduring gratitude, which again brings me, when I read it, to reflection on the gratitude for my teachers. Without people who have carried the practice, we wouldn't have it. So, and knowing that it saved my life is always this taking a moment to feel the gratitude. I'm sure 99% of you were here last week with Ajahn Sumedho. I came too. It was wonderful. The whole room was so full. And seeing him and knowing how many in the West lives he's changed, people he's taught. And then also the wearing of the robe, knowing that through the time of the Buddha, the monastic tradition creates a vehicle to carry the teachings through the decades and through the centuries. So a sense of gratitude there as well, the monks, the nuns, the priests, the lay priests, and also lay women and laymen carrying the teachings for us. So Patachara taught, taking the pestle, young men grind the corn. Supporting their wives and children, they gather up wealth. Do the awakened one's bidding, which, having done, you'll have no regret. Intent on tranquility of awareness, do the awakened one's bidding. Quickly, having washed your feet, go sit to one side. Hearing these words, Patachara's bidding, they washed their feet and retired to one side. intent on tranquility of awareness, they did the awakened one's bidding. In the first watch of the night, they recollected their previous lives. In the middle watch, they purified the divine eye. In the last, they burst the mass of darkness. Getting up, they bowed down to her feet. "We have done your bidding. Like the 30 devas honoring Indra, unvanquished in battle, we, endowed with the three knowledges, effluent free, will continue honoring you." Another reason I like this one is because we're always told the Buddha's teaching is not a set of rules and regulations, except in terms of following a lifestyle like monastic vows and so forth. But it's not like a revealed religion. It's an invitation to follow a path and see for yourself that the Buddha was a human being like us. And here, in this verse, these nuns follow the same process the Buddha. In the first watch of the night, they get to the first stage of enlightenment. In the second watch of the night, they get to the second stage, and so on. So it in the verse illustrates this can be done by ordinary people. It's not just something that the Buddha did and then we pray to the Buddha or something like that. So it's a path for all of us to walk as well. All of us, women and men. And again, this verse for me fits in the feeling of refuge in the Dhamma and also refuge with other women. This is Sona, mother of 10. 10 children I bore from this physical heap. Then weak from that, aged, I went to a nun. She taught me the Dhamma, aggregates, sense spheres, and elements. Hearing her Dhamma, I cut off my hair and ordained. Having purified the divine eye while still a probationer, I know my previous lives, where I lived in the past. I developed the themeless meditation, well-focused oneness. I gain the liberation of immediacy. From lack of clinging, unbound. The five aggregates comprehended stand like a tree with its roots cut through. I spit on old age. There is now no further becoming. Wonderful. It's very contemporary too. I developed the themeless meditation, well-focused oneness. I gain the liberation of immediacy. It's very similar to a lot of the teachings we get now from various people. Now this one, Dantika and the Elephant, again, there's the reflection of the mood of renunciation here, but also it's a beginning for me to see a teaching on right understanding. So right understanding is the first in the list of the Noble Eightfold Path. And it's a particular quality of understanding. One of the strongest parts of it is the seeing of the teaching of causes and conditions giving rise to results, which is the definition of karma. So it's helpful when you're working in Buddhist tradition to forget everything you've heard about that word. It's kind of, it's got all sorts of stuff around it. But actually, in the heart of it is that causes and conditions give rise to certain results, that there is a reflecting quality. For example, wholesome acts will give rise to wholesome results. Wholesome acts will never give rise to unwholesome results. Unwholesome acts will give rise to unwholesome results, never wholesome results. So is that reflecting quality there of the cause as the result comes. So a lot of right understanding is seeing the way things, basically seeing the way things work. This is why the Dalai Lama so often talks about the path as being so scientific. Just to watch what will give rise to what, and to see a second aspect of right understanding is to see that the experiences that arise now are the result of previous action. There's no blame here. It is just very scientific that certain, if in our meditation or in our life, certain wholesome experiences arise, they are the result of wholesome acts. But we have to take a broad view of this because, of course, like that old book, you know, Why Would Bad Things Happen to Good People and so forth. We're talking about a view that is lifetimes and lifetimes and lifetimes. So it turns out that we've all actually done everything. There's no blaming of ourselves or blaming of other people, but of seeing this and seeing this clearly. So Dantika and the elephant, she says, coming out from my days abiding on Vulture Peak Mountain, I saw on the bank of a river an elephant emerged from its plunge. A man holding a hook requested, give me your foot. The elephant extended its foot. The man got up on the elephant. Seeing what was untrained, now tamed, brought under human control, with that I centered my mind. Why I'd gone into the woods in the first place. So what she's saying, you know, you have a little bit of feeling of backstory here. She was meditating all day, and then she came out and she watched this scene. And you get the feeling that maybe when she came out of her day's meditation, she wasn't all that concentrated, you know? Maybe a little subtext of frustration there. But she was focused enough, and she saw this. It's like A plus B equals C, you know? She saw the event. The man said something to the elephant. The elephant responded, and the man got up on the elephant, and she realized that the elephant is a wild animal. And yet, through training, and particularly step by step, some of us might do this with dog training, you know, step by step, positive approach, and so forth. What had once been wild was now tamed. And seeing that reminded her of why she'd gone into the woods in the first place. So there is this sense of seeing the outside world reflecting the truth, and the sense of seeing it so clearly that some insight is accomplished. So we've all had that experience in our meditation where we're practicing and practicing and practicing, and we see a lot coming and going and seeing a lot coming and going. And some of us were talking on the way up here. We read books, and then at some point, we see a sequence. Maybe we see it in our experience. Or we read a chapter that we've read 27 times before, or a scripture, and suddenly it's one, two, ah! And there is the insight into the nature of reality, an insight into cause and effect, an insight into mind-body processes. You know, there are a variety of insights, but they come like that suddenly, seeing clearly. This one is a little bit about the feeling of that. Sumangala's mother. So freed, so thoroughly freed am I from my pestle, from my shameless husband and his sunshade making, from my moldy old pot with its water snake smell. Aversion and passion I cut with a chop. Having come to the foot of a tree, I meditate, absorbed in the bliss. What bliss? So it's quite fun, and you get the little flavor of, you know, cooking and home life, house life, you know, and that sense of freedom. I'm going to give you a different translation of that just for the fun of it. This translation is in Women in Praise of the Sacred by Jane Hirschfield. And she gives a little back story, actually. Sumangala's mother was the wife of a maker of hats and shade umbrellas. So that's where that line come from. Sungamala Mata's verse here is notable for its beginning, a joyous shout at her newfound freedom from the obligations of ordinary life. It is not so much that such tasks and relationships were necessarily problems in themselves, but the attachment and distraction that they represented were. So that in the Tibetan verses a lot, there's that shout right at the beginning. So you see that in many enlightenment verses, an excited shout. At last free, at last I am a woman free. No more tied to the kitchen, stained amid the stained pots. No more bound to the husband who thought me less than the shade he wove with his hands. No more anger, no more hunger. I sit now in the shade of my own tree. Meditating thus, I am happy. I am serene. So the translations do range quite a bit. So it's kind of fun to find different ones. So now we also realize that even with renunciation and on the path, there are pitfalls. And so this one I like because it mentions Mita Kali. Going forth through conviction from home to homelessness, I wandered this place and that, greedy for tribute and gains, missing out on the foremost goal. I pursued a lowly one. Under the sway of defilements, I surrendered the goal of the contemplative life. Then, sitting in my dwelling, I suddenly came to my senses. I'm following a miserable path. I'm under the sway of craving. Next to nothing, my life. Crushed by aging and illness. Before the body breaks apart, I have no time for heedlessness. After watching, as it actually was, the rising and falling of aggregates, I stood up with mind released. The awakened one's bidding done. So it turned out okay. But isn't it wonderful? She saw that. She saw, after even going forth, becoming a nun, that motivation that can take one still in the direction of craving and clinging and so forth. Reading this one, I remembered and printed one of my favorite poems. Again, just a little touch of a male voice in here for fun. Also a non-Buddhist. This, I just love this, so I wanted to share it with you, because it's the same theme as the first part of that verse. So you know Hafiz. Hafiz, about 15th century Sufi. It's called 10,000 Idiots. I have this on my wall. It's always a danger to aspirants on the path when they begin to believe and act as if the 10,000 idiots who so long ruled and lived inside have all packed their bags and skipped town or died. I'll read that one to you again. It's always a danger to aspirants on the path when they begin to believe and act as if the 10,000 idiots who so long ruled and lived inside have all packed their bags and skipped town or died. So it's just the reminder to maintain humility, keep going, keep working. We can fool ourselves quite easily. But then she saw it, and she sat down again and stood up with mind released. Another short one, her name was Dhamma. Wandering for alms, weak, leaning on a staff, with trembling limbs, I fell right down there on the ground. Seeing the drawbacks of the body, my mind was then set free. Some of these are quite wonderful because they let us know that insight can come at any time, at any moment, even when we're just completely, in fact, maybe because, probably, that we're completely exhausted, frustrated, and we just give up. And of course, that's the moment that we're looking for. Give it all up, and then suddenly we've been able to let go and be free. A lot of the women, and of course a lot of the enlightened men as well, contemplating on impermanence, particularly the impermanence of conditioned things. This beautiful one, I just love it. I've shortened it a bit because it's quite long, but you'll get the point right away. This is a quite beautiful, beautiful woman who went forth and into the nun sangha. And so this is her reflection. Again, the impermanence of conditioned things is what I think of. It doesn't have that title, but as I listen, her Ambapali. Black was my hair, the color of bees, and curled at the tips. With age, it looked like coarse hemp. The truth of the truth speaker's words doesn't change. Fragrant like a perfumed basket filled with flowers, my coiffure. With age, it smelled musty like animal fur. The truth of the truth speaker's words doesn't change. Thick and lush, like a well-tended grove made splendid, the tips elaborate with comb and pin, her hair again. With age, it grew thin and bare here and there. The truth of the truth seeker's words, speaker's words, the truth of the truth speaker's words doesn't change. Adorned with gold and delicate pins, it was splendid, ornamented with braids. Now with age, that head has gone bald. The truth of the truth speaker's words doesn't change. curved as if well drawn by an artist. My brows were once splendid. With age, they droop down in folds. The truth of the truth speaker's words doesn't change. Radiant, brilliant like jewels, my eyes. Elongated, black, deep black. With age, they're no longer splendid. The truth of the truth speaker's words doesn't change. Like a delicate peak, my nose was splendid in the prime of my youth. With age, it's like a long pepper. The truth of the truth speaker's words doesn't change. Like bracelets well fashioned, well finished, my ears were once splendid. With age, they droop down in folds. The truth of the truth speaker's words doesn't change. Like plantain buds in their color, my teeth were once splendid. With age, they're broken and yellowed. The truth of the truth speaker's words doesn't change. Like that of a cuckoo in the dense jungle, flitting through deep forest thickets, sweet was the tone of my voice. With age, it cracks here and there. The truth of the truth speaker's words doesn't change. She goes on and on, right through her body, sharing piece by piece. Like a sheet of gold, well burnished, my body was splendid. Now it's covered with very fine wrinkles. The truth of the truth speaker's words doesn't change. Such was this physical heap. Now, decrepit, the home of pains, many pains. A house with its plaster all fallen off. The truth of the truth speaker's words doesn't change. It's a beautiful, beautiful song of impermanence and change of the conditioned things, and that there is something that is changeless, deathless, and that's the truth of the truth speaker. The Buddha's words don't change. Wonderful, eh? Really nice. Again, right understanding. Puna, grown full with good qualities like the moon on the 15th day, with discernment at total fullness, burst the mass of darkness. A very short one. But again, the cycles of the moon and darkness turning to light, and then finally darkness gone. She says, grown full with good qualities. So again, this right understanding, good qualities, good action, wholesome activity gives rise to wholesome results. It's both a promise of our path, and it's the truth. It's the way it is. We just keep persisting in the practice. Keep planting seeds of wholesomeness, seeds of goodness. Just keep going. It's relentless in a way. The old karma might feel that way, but once we enter the path, we persist, just persist. It will take us where we want to go. It's a law of cause and effect. Wholesomeness gives rise to wholesomeness. This one's a dialogue. It's pretty good. So again, the teaching on right understanding is reflected in this one. So it's Punika and the Brahmin. So Punika is a nun, And she is at the river and meets a Brahmin. Punika, I'm a water carrier. Cold. Well, this is before she becomes a nun, actually. Time goes by here. I'm a water carrier, cold, always going down to the water from fear of my mistress's beatings, harassed by their anger and words. But you, Brahman, what do you fear that you are always going down to the water with shivering limbs, feeling great cold? So the Brahman, again, the highest caste in the Hindu tradition, replies, Punika, surely you know. You're asking one doing skillful karma and warding off evil. Whoever, young or old, does evil karma is, through water ablution, freed from evil karma. From evil karma set free. So the scenario there is that there's a belief that if you've done bad actions, comma, you just say unwholesome actions, if you go down to the water and this is rites and rituals, when in the first stage of enlightenment, the teaching is that one is freed from beliefs in rites and rituals. So this is a little dialogue about that particular stage. So the Brahman is saying, you know why I'm here. You know, if I do this ritual of water purification, then I'll be freed from the results of my evil deeds, my evil karma. So then, Punika, then you'd find out who she is really. Who taught you this? The ignorant to the ignorant? One through water ablution is from evil karma set free? In that case, they'd all go to heaven, all the frogs, turtles, serpents, crocodiles, and anything that lives in the water. Sheep butchers, pork butchers, fishermen, trappers, thieves, executioners, and any other evildoers would, through water ablution, be from evil karma set free. If these rivers could carry off the evil karma you've done in the past, they'd carry off your merit as well, and then you'd be completely left out. Whatever it is that you fear, that you're always going down to the water, don't do it. Don't let the cold hurt your skin. So she's playing with words here a little bit too. She's saying, so you have this fear, you're doing this stuff that's making you feel bad, and then you're going down to the water to be purified. How about just stop doing it? And then the cold wouldn't hurt your skin. So there's a little metaphor there. He gets it. So he says, I've been following the miserable path, good lady. And now you've brought me back to the noble. So then he offers her the ritual robe that he was using for the water ablution. I give you this robe for water ablution. And she says, let the robe be yours. I don't need it. If you're afraid of pain, if you dislike pain, then don't do any evil actions, in open or in secret. But if you do or will do any evil karma, any evil actions, you'll gain no freedom from pain, even if you fly up and hurry away. If you're afraid of pain, if you dislike pain, go to the awakened one for refuge, to the Dhamma and the Sangha. Take on the precepts. That will lead to your liberation. And his reply is, I go to the awakened one for refuge. I go to the Dhamma and the Sangha. I take on the precepts that will lead to my liberation. Before I was a kinsman of Brahma, now truly a Brahman. I'm a three-knowledge man. consummate in knowledge, safe and washed clean. Lovely the way it works out that he becomes a true, not just a high caste person, but really a true higher being, because he accomplishes the path. And then because of that, he is truly washed clean. So this is really for us a reflection on right understanding and on the error of rites and rituals, and instead the following of the teachings of right understanding, cause and effect. Unwholesome actions give rise to unwholesome results. Wholesome actions give rise to wholesome results. He says, that's what you should go and do. It's lovely, isn't it? Here's another one very similar to an early one. Mutta just says, so freed, so thoroughly freed am I. From three crooked things set free. From mortar, pestle, and crooked old husband. Having uprooted the craving that leads to becoming, I'm set free from aging and death. And of course, for men, you could easily, we could change the sexes there. But freed from aging and death. And another theme here, again, it's a woman's theme, and there's a little bit of just some things we all recognize. So this is Vimala, the former courtesan. Intoxicated with my complexion, figure, beauty, and fame, haughty with youth, I despised other women. Adorning this body embellished to delude foolish men, I stood at the door to the brothel, a hunter with snare laid out. I showed off my ornaments and revealed many a private part. I worked my manifold magic, laughing out loud at the crowd. Today, wrapped in a double cloak, my head shaven, having wandered for alms, I sit at the foot of a tree and attain the state of no thought. All ties, human and divine, have been cut. Having cast off all effluence, cooled am I, unbound. It's a very beautiful structure there, because the first part you get all this heat and this not taking on clothing, you know, and so forth. But then the opposite happens, where she's in a double robe, you know, quite covered, and yet what she has cast off instead of clothing is all the effluence of mind. And so all that heat has become completely cooled, which is so often a metaphor for the stages of enlightenment. The cooling of that fire, the release, the unbounding of fire, the unbinding. Unbinding. So a final one I'll offer you, it's kind of a little sleeping, like a, what do you do when you sing a baby?
Aloha.
Thank you. Yeah, it's aging. This is anonymous. And the word Terry, that's Terigata Terry, so that's referring to a nun. Sleep, little Terry. Sleep comfortably, wrapped in the robe that you made, for your passion is stilled. like a pot of pickled greens boiled dry. So I just offer those to you for your reflection, for your consideration. There are collections and translations. Susan Murcott has done a book, The First Buddhist Women, and you'll be able to find things on the web as well. The situation is such, and we'll reflect on the various politics and so forth, the circumstances, but we shouldn't miss the verses themselves, because they can be, of course, inspiring and also very funny sometimes, and so real that we can really just taste the flavor of ordinary life in them. And I know they've been inspiration for both men and women to get that sense of the reality of things and the ordinariness of things, and then our struggle, and then the inspiration for the ultimate freedom, that the path can be walked by ordinary folks. So thank you for listening.